Welcome back to Tales of Southwest Michigan's Past. This is Michael Delaware. I am your host. Now, over the past few years, I've had a lot of requests to include some stories from outside of Southwest Michigan. And I usually try to do this with some sort of a connection with the stories to the region. Today's episode, we're going to venture outside the area a little bit farther because we're going to be looking back at some true crime events in Michigan history. Now, although most of these events that we're going to talk about today did not happen per se in Southwest Michigan, but there's no doubt that these crimes in some way impacted all of the state of Michigan, in some cases all over the country. And I'm very excited to introduce to you a guest today. He has written a book on true crime called FBI Case Files Michigan, Tales of a G-Man. And the author is Greg Stayskull. And as you can guess from the title, he is a retired FBI agent. So everybody needs to be on their good P's and Q's out there. So he's going to share some of the fascinating history with us today. And so welcome to the show, Greg. Thank you for taking time to be on the podcast today.
Well, thanks for having me, Michael.
Yeah, well, Greg, could you take a minute and maybe introduce yourself? How long were you with the FBI?
I served from 1975 till 2006, and I was just short of 32 years.
Wow, that is a lot of time. I'll bet you saw a lot of things that you probably still can't talk about.
Well, I saw a lot of things, and some of them, I guess it's better we don't talk about them. Yeah,
that's true. Okay, so when did you decide you wanted to become an author and tell some of the stories that you included in your book?
Well, yeah, that was kind of interesting. After I retired, I had a couple good friends that were involved in journalism. One of them was a guy by the name of Alan Lengel, and Alan used to write for the Detroit News and did the police beat. When they had their big strike back in the, I believe it was the, right around 2000. But anyway, he went to work for the Washington Post and covered federal law enforcement for the Washington Post.
Wow. Well,
ultimately, he came back to Michigan about the time I retired, and he approached me and said, hey, I think you should write some stories. I'm starting up a federal law enforcement blog, and I'd like to have you maybe write some stories or columns for the blog. And so
wow.
I said, you know, I've never done that kind of writing before. And he says, don't worry about it. He says, just do the writing and I'll help you with it. And he did, and kind of went from there.
Wow. So at some point you say, hey, I should put some of these stories in a book.
Yeah, that's right. Sort of an anthology of some of those.
That's kind of how I started with my book on this podcast. I said, well, I really should start taking advantage of all of these stories I've written for the show that I should put into a book of its kind. So one of the interesting cases in your book, when I was looking at it, involved the kidnapping of a GM executive son. Could you go into some of the story behind that one?
Yeah. That was the first year after I had reported to Detroit, and that was 1975. And there were a couple, there were more than a couple. There were four or five really major cases that happened within the first few months I was in Detroit. One of them being the kidnapping of Robert Stemple's son. And Robert Stemple at the time was high up in General Motors. And after the kidnapping, he became the chief executive officer of General Motors for a while. Mm-hmm. But there were two guys that decided they were going to they thought it would be a good idea to kidnap a wealthy kid and then hold him for ransom. So the two guys that decided to go up, and it was a guy by the name of Darryl Wilson and and Clinton Williams. And so they went up to Bloomfield Hills and it was just a random thing. They didn't pick, Robert Stemple's son was named Timothy. They didn't pick Timothy as their particular subject. It just happened to be they saw him on the street, they had passed by a couple other kids, but they decided to kidnap him. They did. There was a he fought back a little bit, but they subdued him, put him in a car, took off, and that's how it started.
Wow. And how long was he a kidnapper or in the hands of the kidnappers?
Well, they held him for close to 3 days. And what they did is they actually put him in the trunk of a car. This was in November in 1975. So it was not. It was a little chilly at night, but they had him. And other than, you know, keeping him in the trunk of a car, he wasn't mistreated beyond that and beyond the initial scuffle they had when they kidnapped him. They started making calls to Robert Stemple with their ransom demands, and they made the calls from a payphone.
Oh, okay. So then, did he alert the FBI or local law enforcement?
What Robert Stemple did is initially he notified General Motors Security, which is their.
I see.
They do their internal investigations and their security people, and they contacted the local police and the FBI. So we became involved, and of course, we immediately started monitoring the phone at the Stemple home. So when the calls came in, we were able to record them. At that time, the technology, phone technology, wasn't what it is today. It wasn't right. Digital, didn't have cell phones, things like that. So we weren't able to trace the calls, other than sort of a general location. But ultimately, what they demanded was $150,000 to be delivered to an empty lot behind a roller rink in Inkster, Michigan. Stemple and General Motors put together a package. We, of course, marked the money and recorded the serial numbers on the ransom. It was delivered to that, and we put Robert Stemple under surveillance so that but it was a very rainy night when he made the delivery. So ordinarily we would have tried to put an airplane up to surveil the site, a couple other things we could do, but because of the weather and everything, we had to stay back. And of course, we did not have the hostage, and the last thing we wanted to do was have any harm done to Timothy Stemple.
How old was Timothy Stemple when this happened?
He was 13 at the time.
Oh, wow. So he was just a young boy.
Yeah.
Wow.
The ransom package was delivered. Our surveillance was unable to see the actual pickup by the kidnappers. At that point, we weren't sure what was going to happen. After a few hours, Timothy Stemple was released. He was taken to a place near Inkster, Michigan, near where the drop site was, and just dropped off. He ultimately made contact with his folks. He was in reasonably good health under the circumstances. And then we began our investigation to try to figure out who the kidnappers were. Of course, Timothy was interviewed at length. He was able to give us somewhat of a description. We learned that it was two black males in their 20s, there was some more specific stuff. He was able to somewhat describe the car that they were driving when they kidnapped him, and some other details like that. But the real break in the case came when we did what we, because the Timothy was dropped off near Inkster, and we were able to trace the payphone to a phone in the Inkster area, we decided that that was probably the site where the kidnappers, at least they were familiar with that area. So we began what we call a neighborhood investigation, where you you go to sort of the drop site and just start interviewing people in the area, see if they saw anything and around where this, to some extent, where the payphone was, that sort of thing. And one of the agents went into a clothing store, and he got lucky. He was describing the individuals that the agent was describing the individuals to the guy that ran the store, the guys that did the kidnapping. He says, well, I'm not sure if it was the same people, but there was a couple guys in here that were purchasing clothes and paid for it in cash. And he still had the bills that were used when the clothing were purchased, and they checked it against the list of serial numbers, and lo and behold, it was part of the ransom money. So, and the store owner had the name. I think there were some alterations to be done on some of the clothing, so he had the name of the individual who had purchased the clothing. That guy was interviewed, and as it turns out, he was not a kidnapper. But what had happened was he had agreed to drive the two kidnappers to a site where they picked up the money, and then they paid him, I believe it was $1,000 for having driven them to the site. He thought it was some sort of drug deal, the guy that drove them, but he knew knew one of the kidnappers' name. A guy by the name of Darryl Wilson, who lived in Ann Arbor, Michigan. So we were able to find out where Darryl lived, and we immediately set up a surveillance there. And I was involved in that surveillance at the apartment. It was on the south side of Ann Arbor. And during the course of the surveillance, I was with another agent, a guy by the name of Stan Lapikas, and Stan and I, Stan got the idea, hey, you know, while we're sitting down here, maybe we should take a look in the dumpster near the apartment on the off chance that maybe they might have gotten rid of something that would have been incriminating. And so the dumpsters had these wooden enclosures around them, and so he and I went inside the enclosure, and Stan got, I think he got the short end of the stick, but he climbed into the dumpster and was looking around. In the meantime, I was standing down below near this gate where the enclosure was, but I was inside the enclosure, and a car parked up right up next to the enclosure where the, where this gate was. So I could see through the slats in the gate that, the guy that had pulled in the car was Darryl Wilson. We had we had obtained a photograph by then. I believe it was his driver's license photo. So I realized it, and so I, Stan and I immediately came out of the enclosure, and we placed Darryl under arrest and put him in the back of our car. We both sat on either side of him. And we explained to him that we knew that he was involved in the kidnapping, acted like we knew more than we did, and and said, and after giving him his rights, we said, hey, you know, we're giving you an opportunity for you to tell your side of the story. And in the process, he told us who the other guy was involved in the kidnapping, a guy by the name of Clinton mm-hmm. Williams. Now, we didn't have any idea about Clinton because no one had identified him. We knew there were two involved, right. but we didn't know who the second one was. So he told us, gave us the name of Clinton Williams and then and his address. So I grabbed a couple other agents and we went to Clinton Williams' residence and arrested him. We took them both to the state police post in Ypsilanti. That was the state mm-hmm. Closest state post. And a couple agents interviewed Daryl, and I interviewed Clinton Williams.
And, wow.
They ended up both confessing to it, to the kidnapping, and we were able to, the agents that were back at the apartment did a search there and were able to recover most of the money. And so they were ultimately prosecuted because there wasn't a federal jurisdictional hook in the sense that they weren't involved really in interstate. They hadn't transported him across state lines or anything like that. There was no interstate communications. Right. So he was charged in state court, and Brooks Patterson, who became, well, at that time he was the Oakland County prosecutor. And because the kidnapping took place mm-hmm. in Oakland County, he prosecuted the case. He ultimately became, I believe, Oakland County commissioner and ran for governor. And so he became
wow.
a pretty big political figure. And part of it was, I think, because he successfully prosecuted this case, which got a tremendous amount of publicity. So
wow.
so at any rate, that's how it happened. And, you know, I had been on the job about 6 months, and
wow.
all of a sudden I'm involved in getting a signed statement from a kidnapper on a major kidnapping. So
wow. Wow, that must have been something.
It was. And
probably a lot of emotions going through your head at that time, I
yeah,
bet.
And the defendants decided they weren't going to get a fair trial in Oakland County, so they moved for a change of venue. And, mm-hmm. you know, they were granted a change of venue, but I think much to their chagrin, the venue was changed to Leelanau County, and they were... tried the case in Leland, and I believe it was the second mm-hmm. day of the trial they both pled guilty without a plea agreement. So they did some pretty heavy time.
Wow. Well, so there was another interesting case in the book about a poisoning at the VA hospital. That sounds quite disturbing. When did that happen?
Well, that case actually happened a little bit before the Stemple kidnapping, and it was a few uh-huh. weeks, just to kind of give you the context. I got to Detroit in June of 1975, and in July of uh-huh. 1975, Hoffa was disappeared, and I worked on that case, as did just about every agent in the Detroit office. And then a few weeks after that, we were alerted that they were had what appeared to be a poisoning of numerous patients at the Veterans Hospital in Ann Arbor. So because mm-hmm. it's a Veterans Hospital, that's a federal facility, so it's federal jurisdiction. So we had a task force of about 20 agents that all went to the Veterans Hospital, and we ended up, and the way we learned that we thought, they had determined, the hospital administration, that it was in fact multiple murders, multiple poisonings, mm-hmm. some of them which resulted in death, but apparently had used a drug, which is Pavulon, which is a muscle relaxant, and taken in a strong dosage, it causes respiratory failure. Pavulon is the synthetic version of Curare, And curare is what some of the indigenous people in South America use in their blowguns and their darts. Oh, okay. And what happens is you go into, you basically become almost catatonic in the sense that you can't move nor can you breathe. Your heart continues to beat, so you're still alive at least until you run out of oxygen. But at any rate, that's what apparently the patients, they had the Veterans Hospital people had, there was an anesthesiologist that figured out what was going on. And so we ended up trying to figure out who had poisoned these patients. And we had, there were over 50 questionable of these respiratory failures. And nine of them resulted in death. And so we had to figure out who had done it. And the key to the whole case turned out to be the fact that Pavilion, in order to cause these seizures, these respiratory failures, had to be administered directly into the IV tube of these patients. None of the patients, none of the questionable arrests were, none of those patients were receiving Pavilion. So it obviously had been administered. And because of the nature and the number, we knew it wasn't an accident. So, and we were able to figure out that all of them had to have been injected with a Pavilion within 3 minutes of the time they had the arrests. So the respiratory arrests, and when they would go into, you know, they would begin to have these failures. And ultimately, an anesthesiologist at the hospital figured out what was going on, and they started giving them the antidote for Pavilion. But realizing that none of these patients had been administered Pavilion, I mean, not as part of their medical protocol. Therefore, we knew that it had been done apparently intentionally. And so what we did is develop a timeline to figure out who was in proximity to these patients at the time. And what we found out, there was only one employee in the hospital that was present and in the proximity of these patients for every one of the arrests. And there were there was reason to believe, we finally narrowed it down to two nurses that were in a position to do this. And they were ultimately arrested, and we were able to, like I say, based on this circumstantial evidence, we were able to put together a pretty strong case, and they were tried. So, but
they were both involved in this? So it wasn't one person. It was two people.
It was two, and we were able to determine, actually had some eyewitness that one or both of them were in the proximity of a couple of these patients just prior to them. One, a family member of one of the victims, actually believed he saw that one of these nurses, the two nurses were both Filipino nurses. One was a Filipino nurse, and the other one was Leonora Perez. Leonora Perez was actually seen at least handling the IV tube of one of the patients just prior to them having an arrest. And another patient said that he actually saw Filipino Narciso appear to get inject something into his IV tube before he had his arrest. So that was some of the evidence we had, in addition to like I say, that they being the only ones that were in the proximity to all of these. I believe we ended up charging was somewhere around 20 arrests, respiratory arrests, 20 some incidents. And like I say, nine mm-hmm. of them ended up in dead. And in order to prove that the deaths were as a result of Pavilion, those bodies had to be exhumed. At the time, there was no test for Pavilion after a body had been embalmed. So the FBI laboratory okay. developed a test that was peer-reviewed to make sure it was accurate. And we were able to show in some of the deaths traces of Pavilion in their systems after wow. we exhumed the bodies. Kind of grisly, but so we were able to charge some of those deaths on one or both of the nurses. So
did either of these nurses ever fess up and
no.
give any kind of indication of what their motivation
was?
They
denied it, and they went to trial. For whatever reason, the defense decided that they had to put the nurses on the stand. And so both of them took the stand, and really probably a key thing, not over and above the evidence that we had, was that so many of the things that they said, the jury, first of all, they realized they were lying because the facts actually contradicted what they were saying. So the jury came to the conclusion they were mm-hmm. lying, and that, I think, was a big factor in them being convicted.
Wow. Wow. Yeah, you really would want to know what was going on. I mean, did they have some kind of beef against the veterans?
Actually, the best we were able to determine, and it would have been helpful to, obviously, to the prosecution if we had a good motive, which, you know, mm-hmm. we were never able, sure. But we think, and both of these nurses were considered good nurses. They weren't malcontents or mm-hmm. anything like that, but both of them strongly believed that, and it was probably true at the time, that the hospital was understaffed. And the best we were able to determine as far as a motive was that they were trying to demonstrate that the hospital was understaffed. And it wasn't that they intended to kill anyone, but ultimately because of the fragile nature of some of the victims' health that they succumbed. But and had they not figured out that it was Pavilion, there might have been others that would have been killed at some point.
Okay. Wow. I bet that changed some of the security protocols for veterans' hospitals across the U.S. after that too, with a case like that on the
line. Yeah,
lines.
I believe so. There was no reason for those nurses to have had access to Pavilion without, you know, mm-hmm. it being part of the protocol. So a lot of those things were tightened up. And, the nurses yeah. were seen in areas of the hospital just prior or just after some of the arrests where they had no business being. They were working mm-hmm. in one wing of the hospital, and they were actually seen in another wing of the hospital, like I say, within 3 minutes of these respiratory arrests. That was part of the evidence as well. Now, the interesting thing that happened
wow.
after the trial and after the two nurses were convicted, the judge ordered them for a 60-day psychological analysis, which isn't necessarily, very unique. But during that period of time, mm-hmm. The judge, when they came back, he did not reverse the verdict, but he ordered a new trial. And by doing that, by ordering a new trial, he made it impossible for the prosecution to appeal because he hadn't reversed the verdict. So they were convicted. Uh-huh. Ultimately, the prosecution decided we could only retry them on the events on the the counts that they were convicted on. And consequently, because the case turned on circumstantial evidence, it had to be cumulative, and it was decided. And of course, we figured that in a retrial, they wouldn't take the stand again. So we thought that, and when I say we, I'm talking about the Department of Justice and the FBI, decided that it would not be worthwhile to try to retry him because it was such a close call.
Okay. So they did go to prison on the original convictions.
No, they did not, because he ordered a new trial, and we did not retry them. So even though they're convicted, they never served any, well, other than the 60-day analysis, they never served any time. So they stand convicted. And there's been, I think, at least one documentary about the case, and one of the children of the nurses has been, you know, vehemently protested. This has been a while back, but about them, their guilt. However, they were convicted by a jury, and consequently, you know, he was. And there was, at the time, and you have to remember, this was in the mid 70s. There were a lot of people that were upset politically because they thought that the FBI had scapegoated two Filipino nurses. But like I say, I mean, I think we would have preferred to have somebody else as a defendant, maybe less sympathetic. But, you know, it's where the evidence took us. So that's why they were prosecuted.
Wow. Fascinating. So there was also one of the stories involving a legendary football coach. More unusual ones, it sounds like, in the book.
And I'm assuming you're talking about Bo Schembechler at the University of Michigan.
Right, Bo Schembechler.
When I was assigned, I originally was assigned to Detroit, and then ultimately I ended up in Ann Arbor, which is a satellite office of Detroit, what in the Bureau they call a resident agency. And we covered five counties out of Ann Arbor. But I ended up being the principal liaison in the office between the athletic department at the University of Michigan and the FBI. And Bo Schembechler had called over and had asked to have some agents come and talk to the football team about different topics, but primarily about illegal sports gambling. Of course, today, sports gambling isn't any longer illegal, but it was then, at least everywhere except Nevada. And so we would go and explain to the athletes, the players on the football team, that about sports gambling, how it works, how they'll, you know, the people that are involved in this stuff are try to get the inside track on information and things like that. Even might try to bribe players. In the worst case scenario, they would try to get players to throw games or to try to cut points. You know, they set the line. We'd explain how all of this stuff works. So I ended up doing that, and Bo invited us back. During the remainder of his career, I started in 82 doing it, and I ended up doing the lecture for the Michigan football team from 82 until 2014. Even after I retired, I continued to do it for a few years. So, and Bo and I got to be pretty good friends. I got to be friends with Lloyd Carr and a number of the other coaches and people that work over in the athletic department. But at one time, and then Bo called me and said, you know, hey, I need to talk to you about something. Can you come over? And so I did. And I went to Bo's office, and Mike Gittleson was there. And Mike was Bo's strength and conditioning coach. And Mike was, well, at that time, they were beginning to realize that anabolic steroids were becoming a problem in college football. And anabolic steroids are nothing more than synthetic testosterone, basically. And taking in order for it to be a performance enhancing drug, you have to take some pretty sizable doses of it. And it it didn't start out this way, but it had become a felony. It became a scheduled drug. And if you were dealing this stuff, it was a felony. And what they had determined, there were a lot of college teams and even some high school players that were using steroids and obtaining them. And they were specifically had noticed there were some players on the Michigan State football team, primarily one in particular, Tony Mandrich, who was a All-American tackle for Michigan State at the time. And Gittleson knew enough about steroids, and he did not he didn't want to see this become so prevalent in the game. So we began an undercover operation to target the trafficking of illegal steroids. And it was really the first of its kind in the country as far as steroids. And it took us a while to get it going because we had to talk people into headquarters and stuff going along with it in the Department of Justice. But you know, the statutes were on the books, and we did go after it. Started out kind of slow, but ultimately it became a national case. And I think to this day, it was the most successful undercover investigation of the trafficking of anabolic steroids. And we determined that it was a big problem for Major League Baseball, and we warned them and got...
What year was that?
The case started in 89, and it sort of very slow in 89. And then the early part of the 90s, we ended up going all over the country, and we worked with the Mounties up in Canada. And when I warned Major League Baseball was the summer of 1994.
That would fit. I remember the Barry Bonds case went down around that time, too.
Yeah, and initially, when I first talked to the people at Major League Baseball, they indicated that they knew that it was a problem, but they also were in the midst of labor problems with the players. Players didn't at that time didn't want to be tested, and they weren't exactly sure how they were going to handle it. And the players went on strike. And then when they came out of the strike.
Yeah, they had the strike in 94 was right around that time. So, wow. So you caused
I didn't cause the strike. They went on strike, but you know, that was the steroid problem was the least of Major League Baseball's problems at the time. And then when they came off of the strike, all of a sudden, they had this flurry of home run hitters. Sosa and McGuire, Canseco, some of these other guys that were, McGuire ended up breaking Roger Maris's record. Well, in the course of our investigation, and the reason I warned Major League Baseball was because one of the dealers we arrested told us he was supplying Canseco and McGuire when they were playing for the Oakland A's. And then later, Canseco, of course, went public and admitted all of that. And but Major League Baseball sort of ignored it for the time being. They kind of thought, well, we'll just leave it alone. These guys are hitting home runs. People are coming to the games. They want to see, people hitting home runs. And we'll just, and So there wasn't much more we could do as far as that, and we pretty much shut the case down. We ended up prosecuting over 70-some dealers, and I think we recovered it was a tremendous amount of steroids, both real and there was a lot of counterfeit stuff, too. But then when Conseco went public and stuff, the whole thing started to blow up. And I was contacted by the New York Daily News because they had talked to this dealer, a guy by the name of Kurt Wensloff, who was the one that supplied Conseco and Meguiar. And he told the New York Daily News what, his involvement. And they said, well, did the FBI talk to Major League Baseball? And Kurt Wensloff didn't know. So then they called the U.S. attorney that prosecuted a lot of the cases, and he referred them to me. And so I get this call, and they said, did you warn Major League Baseball? And technically, I was authorized to speak to the media by the U.S. attorney, but and ordinarily you would just say, no comment. That would sound like we didn't warn them. And so I said, yeah, we warned them. And I told them who we warned and when. And that was the end of that conversation. But the next day, it was all over the media, all over the country, that we had warned Major League Baseball and they had ignored it. And of course, the whole thing during the 90s was this huge steroid scandal that broke. So anyway.
Yeah. I remember 94 after the strike happened. I mean, I was a huge baseball fan back then, and I was so upset, and so were many fans, that when they canceled the World Series that year, that was like the worst thing ever. I was a Braves fan, so we were likely to go to the World Series that year. And I remember the following year, I mean, the Braves did win the World Series in 95, and the but it was really hard. They Major League Baseball lost a lot of their hardcore fan base in 95 going because of that strike. And it took a few years for them to build back up to full stadiums again. In a lot of these major cities, and I think they were hurting financially. And of course, they're going to try to sweep anything under the rug just to keep eyes off the steroid thing.
Like I say, this home run derby thing that was going on with Sosa and Meguiar and a couple other guys, that was piquing a lot of people's interest and stuff. And unfortunately, they were performance enhanced guys. So,
it was quite a time.
Ultimately, baseball denied that I had warned them, caused a big thing. And, one day I was sitting in the office and was talking to somebody and our office manager walked in. She handed me a note and said, Mike Wallace is on the phone and he wants to hold. And I knew headquarters had already told me not to say anything to anybody. But I talked to Mike Wallace and I said, hey, I can't give you anything. I explained. He said, well, can you give me anything on background? And I just basically told him the same thing I had told the New York Daily News and about our case and stuff. And he wanted to put me on 60 Minutes. And I said, well, they're not going to give me authority to do that. So anyway, there's a bunch of stuff like that.
That's fascinating. Yeah. So did you find any cases that were really challenging to solve during that you included in the book, or maybe just from your years of experience?
Well, I mean, obviously the Veterans Hospital case was, that was,
that was a
whodunit. But, I my involvement in that one was sort of tangential. I did a lot of interviews and stuff. But one case in particular was one with a guy by the name of Richard Debs, was head of a local UAW chapter at Willow Run. And that was General Motors Ford had originally had a plant there, and that's where they built the B-24s during World War II. But the General Motors had an assembly plant there where they built the Impala. And this was, and Debs was head of the that union local for that plant. And he had been the president for about 15 years, but he was being challenged. He wasn't the most popular guy in the world, and he was being challenged by two guys that were going to run against him. And one of them was Jesse Gray, and the other one was a guy by the name of Bob Harlow. And we had a source that had come to us who said that Richard Debs was trying to get some people to intimidate Harlow and Gray to not run against him for the presidency of the local. And he had talked to, and the source knew several people who Debs had talked to, probably not all of them, but he knew several. So, and we weren't sure, you know, what exactly had transpired or if he had actually gotten anybody to do it. So we brought in Jesse Gray and Bob Harlow and said, hey, we've picked up information that looks like, you know, Debs is trying to solicit people to do violence towards you. And so they said, well, what should we do? And we told them, well, you know, be careful and to, you know, switch up your routine. Don't go to work the same way all the time and, you know, change your routines as best you can. Be vigilant. You know, if you notice anything, let us know. If we get any more additional information, we'll pass it on to you. Not too long after that, Jesse Gray, on his way to driving to the Willow Run plant, a car passed his, he was driving a pickup truck, car came past him, and somebody in the car fired several rounds at his truck. One of them hit him in the neck, and, you know, could have very close to being a fatal wound. It wasn't, but he decided he wasn't going to run against Debs. Bob Harlow decided he was going to stay in it. We talked to Harlow again, and he said, well, yeah, I did what you told me to do. I switched my routine and stuff. Jesse Gray had not. He sort of ignored our advice.
Just ignored it, huh?
I don't know if he, you know, sometimes habits are hard to break, but he had ignored us. But now we did a full court press and started, we interviewed the people that Debs had had contacted. Before we hadn't wanted to interview him until we, because we didn't want to alert Debs as to what we knew. So we interviewed them. They all indicated that, yeah, Debs had contacted them and stuff. None of them, and we were able to determine, none of them were involved in the shooting, and they had not agreed to do it. And when I say we, it was the Michigan State Police and me, basically, where one detective from Michigan State Police and I were the only ones involved. And we also interviewed Debs, and of course he denied it, and he had an alibi. He said he and his wife were in Cleveland when it occurred. So we kind of were running out of options as to what to do on this thing. And ultimately, the state police said, you know, we can't justify, you know, continuing this investigation. Well, I felt there were a couple loose ends that I should at least follow up on. And one of them was to interview a guy by the name of Larry Poor, who was one of these people that we knew had been contacted by Debs. We did not think he was involved in the shooting, but we knew he had been contacted by Debs. Mm-hmm. So I went and interviewed him. State police were no longer involved. So when I went to see Poor, he said, yeah, Debs came to me and wanted me to confront the Harlow and Gray and persuade him not to run against him and to... I said, oh, okay. But he said, you know, I said to Debs, I don't even know these two guys. I wouldn't even know them if I saw them. And so Debs came back and gave him a photograph of one of the guys. And he said, I had this photograph. But he said, you know, I never did it. I told him at first, you know, I'd think about it. And then I finally just told him, I'm not going to do it. I said, okay. And so at that point, I was finishing up the interview. I had now four or five people that told me that Debs had approached them. But these guys, mm-hmm. yeah, they're not, when you get people to do this kind of stuff, you don't get Board Scouts. So these guys probably weren't the most mm-hmm. credible witnesses in the world. And we really didn't have much else. So as I'm getting ready to leave Larry Poor's residence, he says to me, would you want that photo? You know, I hadn't even thought to ask for it. So I said, yeah, I would want that photo. So he gave me the photo. I was very careful with it, stuck in an evidence envelope. And I got back to the office. I sent it to the lab, the FBI laboratory. I wasn't expecting much, but I thought, you know, it's worth a shot. And the next thing, when the lab came back to me, I had them check it for the photograph for fingerprints. There were two identifiable prints on the picture, Larry Poor's and wow. Richard Debs. So now I had a photograph of Jesse Harlow with the fingerprints of Larry Poor, who told me that he was given the photograph by Debs with his photo. All of a sudden mm-hmm. now I've got corroboration, not only for what Larry Poor told me, but what for everybody else had told us was that Debs was trying to get these guys taken care of. There was one other loose end. We knew, and later on Debs was convicted of this, but we knew that Debs was a pedophile. And that he would solicit young men mm-hmm. for sex. And one of the individuals that he had solicited, we went and interviewed him. And that individual, he didn't admit that he had had sexual relations with Debs, but he did say to us mm-hmm. that Debs had come to him prior to going to Cleveland. Debs, one night, he and his wife, Richard Debs and his wife, had gone to this individual, who I'll call John, and said to John, mm-hmm. I'd like for you to drive us to Cleveland tonight. And it was like 10, 11 o'clock at mm-hmm. night. And the guy goes, well, and he agreed to pay him to do it. I can't remember. It was a couple $100. So the guy agreed to do it. He was driving Deb's car. He wasn't driving his own. And so they drove to Cleveland, went to a house, and Debs and his wife got out, went into the house, and Debs says to John, come back in the morning about 9, 10 o'clock and pick us up. And so the kid said, okay. So the kid went and got a motel room or something, and the next morning, he picked up Debs and his wife and drove them back to Michigan. They dropped him off at John's house, and he assumes they went home. Well, when we interviewed Debs about the shooting of Jesse Gray, he said to us, I wasn't around when that happened. I was in Cleveland. So all of a sudden, it dawns on us that, oh, wait a minute. This whole thing was all about setting up an alibi. And he needed a witness to verify it if he checked up on it. So, like I say, this kid picked him up at I mean, took them there about 11 o'clock at night, and turns around the next morning, about 10 hours later, and drives them back to Michigan for the sole reason that they could say they were in Cleveland when the shooting took place. At least that's what I believe. Wow. Anyway, with that, the photograph, the interviews, and everything else, I presented it to the U.S. attorney, and we charged Debs under what they call the Hobbs Act, which is labor racketeering, where you're not allowed to conspire to defraud the membership of a union or a local. And he, in effect, was doing that by not giving them an opportunity to vote for opposition. And among the counts in the indictment was that Debs was involved in the shooting. We knew we couldn't prove he was involved in the shooting, but we could at least put it in front of the jury. Mm-hmm. We could prove everything else, but Debs ultimately pled guilty, not to the shooting, but to the other count. So he ended up going to jail.
Wow.
But that was one of the cases.
Well, these are fascinating, fascinating stories.
So that was, to me, was one of the, it was not, I guess there's always a certain amount of ambiguity to this stuff, but that was, particularly for me anyway, a very rewarding case. So.
Wow. So where can people get a copy of your book? Is it, do you have a personal website, or do you just go to other online bookstores?
No, it's published by Arcadia, the History Press, and you can get it on Amazon. You either search it for the title or for my name. Barnes & Noble, some of their stores have it, or you can order it through Barnes & Noble online. And then some of the local Michigan bookstores have it as well. So it's pretty available.
Okay. Are you working on any new books?
I've been doing, I've continued to do some writing, but most of it hasn't been the same type of true crime kind of thing. I've been writing columns, in effect, I guess, defending the Bureau as to some of the allegations and stuff that have come out recently. If you believe some of the stuff you see online or some of the new stuff have carried, like the weaponization of the FBI against certain people and things like that. So I've been writing those kind of columns, which, although they're objective, some people view them, I guess, as being political. So,
yeah. Very strange times we live in right now, that's for sure.
Yep.
Well, it's been fascinating talking to you, Greg. Any last minute comments you want to say about your book before we wrap up today?
Well, there's 20-some chapters, and every one of them is a different case that I was involved in. I think the thing that I like to stress when I talk about the book is that this isn't a memoir. It's not about me. It's about high-profile cases that I was involved in, some more so than others. But I didn't do anything in my career that I did by myself. It was always a team effort. There's always other people involved. I was part, I believe, of a great team. Sometimes it involved local law enforcement and obviously other agents and, our laboratory and the other resources that we have. But that's the thing I want to stress. I mean, I use the first person pronoun sometimes in the book, but that's the point is you don't do anything in the Bureau by yourself. It's always a team effort. Kind of like what Bo used to say about the team.
Yeah, I think that goes with a lot of branches of law enforcement. It's really never just one that keeps the peace and keeps things sorted out and organized and safe for everybody. But do appreciate all the years that you did serve the country with keeping America safe. A lot of these stories could have been really bad if they hadn't been solved. And especially that case with the VA is kind of scary. They could have continued going on and on and on, and you wouldn't have known about it and had you know, somebody not taking time to really investigate it. So
yeah, well, it was
that's great.
You know, I wanted to be an FBI agent since I was a kid, and it and then I was fortunate in not only in being one, but fortunate to be involved in a lot of great cases. And it was a very rewarding career. And, you know, I enjoyed going to work every day. So,
wow, I'll bet. Well, it's been a pleasure, Greg. I've been, I hope to have you back on again sometime. You know, it's been just.
Anytime, I'd be happy to.
Absolutely.
You don't get too bored with my stories. So.
No, they're great. They're just great. So I have been speaking with Greg Stayskull. He has written a book called FBI Case Files Michigan, Tales of a G-Man. And I'm going to put the link in the show note description of where you can get Greg's book. Definitely a fascinating read. And as we heard today, some amazing detail in the stories of the involvement and the many layers of sorting out these crimes that affected not only Michigan, but the nation. And just wonderful having you on today, Greg. I appreciate you coming on the podcast.
Well, thanks, Michael. I enjoyed it.
Well, thank you, sir. So this is going to wrap up today's show, folks. If you would like to get a copy of Greg's book, I'll put the link in the show note descriptions. If you'd like to reach out to me, you can find me, as always, at michaeldelaware.com. And I am always happy to hear from my listeners. You can also follow me on Facebook at Michael Delaware Author. And also on Instagram at Michigan History Guy. And until next time, when we take another journey into yesterday, we explore even more fascinating tales of Southwest Michigan's past. Thank you for listening.